as it seemed to be the case here, it started to go wrong. On my right, the first door stood open wide. Another bedroom. A third large man, dressed like the two downstairs, lying on his back, leaked enough to require that the carpet be replaced. The uniformity of their dress began to seem like stage clothes, costumes, as though they must be members of a weird punk band, musicians who moonlighted as killers. I won't go on about how my heart was pounding and my mouth was dry. Been there, described that. Because there were no shattered mirrors or bullet holes in the walls, no visible damage from any misspent rounds, it appeared that none of the assassins had gotten off a shot. But such incompetence seemed unlikely. I thought I must be missing something, the kind of missed something that would get me shot in the head. Nevertheless, I moved silently along the hall, toward the second door on the right. A large painting of mountains towering above a lake and splashed through with spectacular light, maybe a print of something by Albert Bierstadt, abruptly disappeared soundlessly up into the wall as if on pneumatic tracks, leaving only the ornate frame. Where the painting had been was now an opening into the room toward which I'd been headed. Standing there, aiming a silencer-equipped pistol at my face, Mr. Bullock managed to check himself before he blew me away. He raised his eyebrows and whispered, "Get in here." As the painting slid quietly back into place, I stepped to the door, went into another bedroom, and found that Maybelle Bullock was alive too. She eased the door almost shut, and her husband put a finger to his lips. I saw that a different painting, perhaps a print of another Bierstadt, hung here, directly behind the one in the hall, and it evidently retracted simultaneously with the other. Mrs. Bullock held a device I'd never seen before, about the same width as a cell phone and twice as long. A screen occupied the top half, and two rows of buttons were positioned under it. Nothing on the screen but a field of cool blue. She swung it away from the wall that this room shared with the hallway, toward the wall between this room and the next room, as a fairy godmother might gesture with a magic wand and leave the air sparkling in its wake. On the blue screen, a red form shaped itself out of pixels. Not anything identifiable, just a shimmering horizontal mass on a field of blue. It twinkled, constantly adjusting around the edges. My guess, we were watching the heat signature of assassin number 4 as he moved cautiously through the room adjacent to this one. As Maybelle moved her hand slowly, from right to left, keeping the red form in the center of the blue screen, tracking it, Deacon stepped to a large painting hung to the left of the bed. This one looked as if it might be a print of something by John Singer Sargent. Deacon aimed the gun at the painting as if he were an art critic with violent tendencies. His wife pressed a button on the device she held. The artwork vanished up into the wall, leaving only the frame, in which a fourth assassin stood no more than 3 feet from the muzzle of Mr. Bullock's pistol. Mr. Bullock fired twice, point blank, and the hitman dropped out of sight as if he had stepped through a trap door. I started to speak, but Mr. Bullock frowned and put a finger to his lips again. Then he put the same finger to his right ear and pressed on something that resembled a hearing aid. I hadn't noticed it before. A wire ran behind his ear and down his side to an object about the size of a walkie-talkie that was clipped to his belt. He listened for half a minute, pulled the microphone from his ear and said, "Al says no more damn fools, inside or out." "Whose house?" I asked, assuming it was a name.
"This here house, son."
Mrs. Bullock said, "House computer, Roddy. It's got itself eyes and ears everywhere."
"Weight sensors, heat sensors, a whole gaggle of sensors," her husband added.
"So you knew when I got here?"
"We knew," Mrs. Bullock said, "but we was too busy staying alive to check video and see who you was."
"I had to figure you for another of them bastards," Mr. Bullock said. "Sorry if maybe I just about killed you dead."
"That's all right, sir.
Call me Deke, why don't you?"
"Yes, sir." 32. While we waited for the cleanup crew, Maybelle Bullock insisted that we have coffee spiked with Bailey's. We took it in mugs, in the dining room rather than the kitchen, because the dead man lying half in the dining room hadn't soiled himself while dying, as had the dead man lying half in the kitchen. The air smelled nicer in the dining room. The Bullocks sat side by side, frequently exchanging little smiles that I presumed to be expressions of approval about how each had performed in the crisis. I sat across the table from them. Mrs. Bullock said, "Well, Addie, we didn't figure you'd be back till late." I put a few things together and realized a safe house was going to be attacked. "I'm sorry I brought them down on you." She looked surprised. "Oh, shush. Wasn't nothing you did, or even you being here, that caused this darn foolishness."
"This here kind of squabble happens once in a while," her husband assured me.
"Squabble?"
"Tussle, scrap, whatever you feel like calling it."
"Every now and then," said Maybelle, "their kind gets a beat on one of our safe houses, so they show up all full of mayhem."
"An operation like this here tonight," Mr. Bullock said, "takes these bastards some planning. For sure they've been on to us some weeks now, long before you come round."
Maybelle said,
"Maybe it was 'cause of the astronaut they got on the scent of this lovely place."
"Or that cute as a button ballerina girl," said Mr. Bullock.
His wife grimaced and shook her head.
"Oh, they wanted that dear girl so bad. A thousand of their kind would have slit their own throats if maybe it would gain them just a thin chance to slit hers."
"Do these squabbles always end like this?" I asked.
"Gracious, no," Maybelle said.
She smiled at her husband and then looked at me again.
"Was it that easy, then this war would be done before it ever did start."
"Sometimes it's our folks end up dead as dirt."
Deacon winked at his wife.
"But not here and now."
"Not here and now," she said.
Mentally, I was wobbling a little from thinking about the scope of the secret conflict that all this implied. I didn't realize the cult was so big.
"Them cultists that want to sink their teeth in you, dear? Why, they aren't big at all. Them and others like 'em wasn't the ones would have killed our astronaut had they got their hands on him."
"Or that little ballerina," her husband said.
"Or that army lieutenant. He won the big medal."
"Or that comedian years ago. We had to fake his death and do him a new face."
"It's not one cult," Maybelle said. "It's a way of thinking."
Mr. Bullock agreed.
"Thinking, what is it I want? And how can I take it from someone that has it?"
"Thinking, who is it I hate or envy most? And how can they be got rid of?" Maybelle said.
"Thinking, can't be me made a mess of my life. Must be your fault, so you're gonna pay."
"A way of thinking," I said. "But it's a way that an awful lot of people think."
"But not anywhere's near the most of them," Maybelle said. "Not the most. And that's one reason why doing what we do is worth doing."
"I hope you're right, ma'am."
"Call me Maybelle."
"Yes, ma'am." "What happens to you now?"
"Me and Deke? We move on wherever."
"Wherever?"
"Wherever Edie Fisher thinks best. Most often some far place from where we was last."
"So the cleanup crew you mentioned deals with the dead bodies?"
"Well, it's partly what keeps them busy."
"What happens to this house?"
Mr. Bullock said, "Cleanup crew tears all the tricks out, puts things back like they was before us. Makes it normal as normal ever can be, so it'll get sold. No safe house never can be a safe house again once the bastards know about it."
Mrs. Bullock finished her spiked coffee and smiled.
"We've been here 3 interesting years, made some fine memories, but it does a person good to move on from time to time. Keeps you fresh."
Mr. Bullock reached into his shirt pocket.
"I hate how it vibrates like a squirming lizard."
He produced a cell phone, put it to his ear, said,
"Yeah,"
3 times,
"dang,"
once, and
"no,"
twice, before he terminated the call. His wife asked,
"Clean up?"
"Yep, them boys got a job and a half this time around. They'll be pulling in the driveway in about 2 minutes.
I said, "They got here really fast."
"This team's mostly close. A lot of the time just over in Vegas. Got themselves more cleaning up to do there than here."
Looking at my watch, I said, "Did they teleport or something?"
We had us three false alarms today, he said.
One just before dinner, I remembered.
Right after that, I called out to Vegas for cleanup, told them there's likely to be one mess or the other.
How did you know the alarms weren't false?
One false alarm in a day, Maybelle said, might be nothing but truly false. More than one? Well, then you got to figure they're as real as my own teeth.
You've got beautiful teeth, ma'am.
Thank you, Artie. I always say everything worthwhile starts with a nice smile.
Mr. Bullock got up from his chair.
Boss lady's right behind the crew.
I rose to my feet. You mean Mrs. Fisher?
About 6 o'clock, she come into town from the coast with them three friends of yours.
That would be Anna Maria, Tim, and Blossom Rosedale, the happy monster.
Edie holed up somewhere safe with him, Mr. Bullock said. We don't got to know where, don't want to know. She's come here just herself now, with the cleanup crew, so she can chat with you, son.
The three of us stepped onto the front porch as a 40-foot box truck and a paneled van appeared out of the dark colonnades of Velvet Ash. Neither vehicle sported a company name. They swept past the house to park in the backyard. A black, super-stretch Mercedes limousine with tinted windows followed close behind the paneled van and stopped in the driveway near the front porch. The driver doused the headlights.
Mr. Bullock said, Edie wants to see you in the car, son. The biggest dang snoops in the world, with all their evil electronic ears, won't never hear but even a word of what's said in that limo. Get in the front, 'cause she's driving herself.
33. The night before my return to Pico Mundo, the sea, the shore, the cottage. Anna Maria and the boy Tim asleep in their rooms, and I in mine, the bedsheets damp with sweat. The nightmare of chaos and cacophony. In a place without detail, where luminous smears of red and blue and gold and white and green whirled and pulsed, swooped toward me and soared as if they were shapeless birds of light. A place of harsh sound. Music too shrill and tortured to be called music. Voices that spoke what I knew to be English, but could not understand. Screams and panicked shouting. There had been faces all around me, swelling and receding and swelling again. But now there were only parts of faces, eyes looming out of the blur of light, a mouth wide and howling, a nose with cavernous nostrils, a rouged cheek, and an ear with a silver loop dangling from the lobe. At my side, supporting me as if I were drunk, Blossom Rosedale maneuvered me through the bedlam as I clutched an urn to my chest. Chief Wyatt Porter had appeared out of the tumult, calling my name. He pointed his pistol at me, and the muzzle had grown until it was as large as the mouth of a cannon. He'd fired the gun, and with the crack of the shot, he'd disappeared into the pandemonium once more. Blossom led me onward. As scenes and dreams often transition one into the other without logic, I found myself lying on my back on a hard surface, holding fast to the urn, the mysterious urn that held the ashes of countless dead. All the strident noise had faded. Music without harmony and the shrill voices and the screams. The kaleidoscopic play of light and smears of brilliant color had given way to a warm golden glow and a soft surrounding grayness. Standing around me, three lovely women with white and gold feathered faces regarded me with solemn brown eyes. They had noses and mouths. Not beaks. Although I tried desperately to hold on to the urn, strong hands took it from me, and I lacked the strength to resist. I could see that the bird women were speaking, whether to one another or to me, but I couldn't hear what they said. Another face appeared, the beautiful, fire-scarred and broken face of Miss Blossom Rosedale. Beside Blossom materialized Terry Stambaugh,
the woman who owned the Pico Mundo Grill, who had given me a job when I was 16 and helped me to master my natural talent as a hash slinger, refining me into a griddle master. I tried to speak to Blossom and to Terry, but I had no voice. I could neither hear nor be heard. The spirits of the lingering dead can't talk, but they can hear, therefore my current deafness proved that I was not dead. For a moment, I closed my eyes, and when I opened them, I seemed to be alone. I tried to look around, but I couldn't lift my head. I couldn't sit up. I couldn't move as much as one finger. Panic took me. I thought that I must be paralyzed. But then Anna Maria spoke to me, and her voice at once calmed me, though I couldn't see her. "Well, young man, you've had quite a day." Another of those dream transitions left me sitting in a chair, across a table from Anna Maria. Between us stood a wide, shallow bowl containing an inch of water, and in the water rested an exquisite white flower larger than a cantaloupe, thick white petals spiraling from a loose perimeter to a tight center. During our 4 months of friendship, this flower graced rooms where Anna Maria lived. In the cottage by the sea, there were always bowls of these enormous blooms. She claimed that she cut them from a tree in the neighborhood. Although I went on long walks for blocks in every direction, I never saw a tree laden with such flowers. Back in January, in the town of Magic Beach, using the flower, Anna Maria had performed a magic trick of some kind for Blossom Rosedale, but I hadn't been present to see it. The happy monster had been amazed, astonished, exhilarated by the illusion with the flower. Anna Maria promised that she would perform it for me, too, when the time was right. In her ever-mysterious way, she never felt the right time had arrived. Until now, here in a dream. "The flower," she said, "is the amaranth." Around my neck, upon a chain, the thimble-sized bell given to me by this woman, on the occasion when she asked if I would die for her, began tinkling sweetly, although I did not move. The tiny silver clapper beat against the silver strike and silver lip, perhaps to call me to some task, perhaps to celebrate some pending triumph, perhaps to warn me of a mortal threat. Anna Maria began to pluck loose the largest of the petals, those around the perimeter of the bloom, and drop them on the table. They were as thick as if they'd been peeled from a wax flower. At first they glowed snow-white against the wood, then began to yellow, turn brown. Soon they withered, even as they fluttered from her fingers. The silver bell rang faster, louder. Fear welled again as the petals began to discolor and shrivel before she could pluck them. The deterioration of the bloom accelerated, racing from one petal to the next, around the spiral pattern, rapidly toward the center. Louder, the silver bell, louder, faster. I tried to tell her to stop. She was killing not the flower, she was killing me. I could not speak. The large petals fell out of the flower of their own accord, as if they were puzzle pieces from a picture of a beaten and bruised man, quickly curling, cupping, now as crisp as the skin from a desiccated corpse. I thrust straight up, out of the dream, sweating and gasping, damp sheets clinging to me as if they were a shroud, as if I had sat up not in bed, but from a granite slab in a morgue, where an autopsy was about to be performed on me. At the end of the silver chain around my neck, the tiny bell rang three times. Each time it sounded less insistent than in the nightmare. Then it fell silent. I had awakened late. Anna Maria and young Tim had finished their breakfast. They were off somewhere together. After a shower, I packed what little I needed in my toiletries case and in a soft-sided overnight bag. I loaded them in the big dog motorcycle's saddlebags. Anna Maria and Tim returned on foot at 1:30, having eaten a light lunch at a restaurant in town. The boy had not been much like a boy,
emotionally and intellectually, when we rescued him from horrific circumstances in that Montecito estate. He'd been old beyond his years, but day by day he seemed to forget what he had endured. Soon he became an ordinary, energetic boy of 9. This change had been wrought by Anna Maria, but she declined to explain how she could have done what an entire corps of psychiatrists and a pharmacy of the latest antidepressants would surely have failed to achieve. Now Tim wanted to change into his swim trunks and search the shore for seashells, go wading, swim a little. Anna Maria preferred to keep him in sight when he was on the beach. She said she'd been pregnant a long time, and would be pregnant longer still, but she declined to say if this child she carried was her first. As she was 18, it most likely would be her first. Yet, as she had shown with Tim, she had about her the wisdom and the manner of someone well experienced in mothering. As the boy entertained himself along the breaking surf, plucking up half-buried shells to add to his collection, we stood seaward of the picket fence that separated yard grass from sand. Between the clear sky and the blue rolling sea, brown pelicans glided northward in formation. She said, "So, odd one, you had a dream, and the bell rang you to action last night." "How could you know?" "The way things are known," she said with an enigmatic smile. "A dream, but not just a dream." "Not just a dream," I agreed. "Chief Porter was in it, so I must have been in Pico Mundo, but I don't know exactly where." "You've known since Nevada. The cult will strike in Pico Mundo." "You're in the dream," I said. "Will you be there for real?" "I phoned Edie Fisher this morning. Tim and I will go out there with her. I wouldn't miss it, young man." "What is it you wouldn't miss?" "Whatever is to be." "There you go again. Where do I go? In clouds of mystery. By the way, you frightened me in the dream." She put a hand on my shoulder. "I will endeavor not to frighten you, for real." I watched him dancing jubilantly in the foaming surf. "Should I be afraid?" "Not of anything in Pico Mundo," she said. "Of what comes after Pico Mundo?" "Don't lay out an entire itinerary, Adi. Take one destination at a time." 34. When I got into the front passenger seat of the limousine and closed the door behind me, Mrs. Fisher grabbed one of my hands in both of hers, pulled me toward her, and kissed me on the cheek. "Child," she said, "even the sweetest baby in a cradle isn't more kissable than you." She was a pixie, an inch short of 5 feet, perched on a pillow to see over the steering wheel. At 86, she had more energy and considerably more gumption than the average 30-something corporate hotshot. "I've missed you, Mrs. Fisher."
"And I've missed you too, my dear chauffeur."
As I've detailed in the next-to-last volume of these memoirs, I'd been employed as her chauffeur for an event-packed day or so, during which she'd done most of the driving.
"But of course," she continued in her lilting voice and cheery manner, "I've been busy helping our little network of like souls to neuter as many rotten scum as we have time to confront. I'm sorry to say, there are so many rotten scum in these perilous times that some days I fear we're falling behind. But then..."
She looked toward the front porch, where the cleanup crew had joined Mr. and Mrs. Bullock and were following them into the house.
"But then sometimes the rotten scum come to us, which saves us the trouble of finding them."
She looked at me again and frowned.
"What is it, dear? You don't appear to be having as much fun as you should be having, after all your success in Nevada."
"A lot of people died there, ma'am."
"Yes. Many of those kidnappers and would-be child killers died, but the children all lived, thanks to you. Don't mourn the death of monsters, dear. Celebrate the saving of the innocents."
"You're right.
I know you're right. I guess what disturbs me isn't so much killing the killers. It's the necessity of killing them, that they push us to that.
We're not engaged in police work, child. This is war. A secret war at our level of the action, but a war nonetheless. There are fewer shades of gray in a war than in police work.
She had one of those faces, fine-boned and symmetrical, that not only weathered the years well, but also pushed the grandmother love button deep in your psyche, so that you took seriously whatever she said and felt it to be wise. Her soft skin hadn't wrinkled randomly, hadn't puckered her face in unflattering ways. Every line seemed to have been designed to maintain a gentle and genteel countenance, and to have been executed by a seamstress to royalty. "Ma'am, as totally impressive as your network was when we worked together back in March, I'm only now beginning to realize its true scope. You and Heathcliff must have built quite a fortune." Heathcliff, her husband, apparently had been many things, including a magician. No, what she told me exactly was that he could appear to be a magician, that he could appear to be anything he wished, and convincingly.
"Oh, dear, don't give me too much credit. Heathcliff already had a Scrooge McDuck fortune when he met me and saved me from a life as a mediocre actress. Over the years, my little ideas added only a couple of hundred million to the pot. Anyway, I'm not the only one who funds the resistance. Now tell me, what should we be afraid might happen to your darling little Pico Mundo?"
She'd left the engine running so that we could have air conditioning in the warm desert night. Although the instrument panel in the dashboard had been dialed up to its brightest level, the limo was softly illuminated. I felt cocooned and, as I always did in her company, quite safe in a dangerous world. I told her about the dream of the flood, about Malo Suerte Dam and the stolen 1,000 kilos of C4. "But you see, ma'am, I never know about my dreams. Sometimes they're literal, other times only symbolic. If I have to live with this gift, I don't understand why things can't always be clearer to me." Patting my cheek affectionately, she said,
"Because, dear boy, then you would be just another silly superhero who's never really at risk."
I could live with that.
"But you might then grow too certain of yourself, cocksure and arrogant, even you. And then you might become one of the very people that my network of friends must thwart. Isn't that a lovely word? Thwart."
"Thwart? I've never thought about it, ma'am."
"Well, do think about it, dear. Please do. It's a lovely word. Thwart. To obstruct is as noble an act as to facilitate, if what you are obstructing is the facilitation of evil. Anyway, to maintain the right perspective, sweetie, we always should be at risk of failure, the possibility of making wrong choices."
"Free will, you mean?" Pinching my cheek this time, Mrs. Fisher said,
"Now there's the lovely fry cook who could save this town. You're very nearly fully smooth and blue."
"Fully smooth and blue? I still don't know what that means, ma'am."
"Oh, don't puzzle yourself. You'll know what it means when you know. Meanwhile, there isn't going to be a test about it."
She was dressed in a pink pantsuit with a frilly white blouse. On the lapel of her jacket glimmered the exclamation point crafted of gold, diamonds, and rubies. "I don't know what that means either. A version of it turns up on the phone you sent me."
"It's a kind of logo," Mrs. Fisher said. "It's like that Pepsi circle with the red, white, and blue waves in it. Or the smiling cow on a can of Lucerne whipped cream."
"Cows and cream. Okay, that I understand."
"Of course you do. A smiling cow makes everyone feel good. A smiling cow is a delightful thing, and whipped cream is delightful."
"But the exclamation point."
"Well, it's also a promise."
"A promise of what?"
"And a statement of conviction. It's many things, dear. Just as anything you can point at in this world is many things."
I pointed at her. She pointed at me. I couldn't help but laugh. I wish Stormy could have known you, ma'am. She'd think you were a hoot.
She was a lovely girl. She still used the name Bronwyn then. Hadn't quite started calling herself Stormy. We got along famously.
Mrs. Fisher could draw upon a greater variety of smiles than anyone I'd ever known, perhaps because the life she'd lived had given her so many different kinds and degrees of happiness. The smile with which she favored me now was one I'd seen several times before, what I might call the smile of pleasurable expectation, with her head cocked to one side and her blue eyes bright with curiosity regarding my response to her revelation, also with an impish pleasure in having astonished me.
You knew Stormy? How did you? When did you?
Mrs. Fisher took one of my hands in both of hers again and pressed it firmly.
After she was adopted by that dreadful couple, after that horrible thing happened, our little organization got her out of the situation.
Stormy was 7 years old when her parents died in a plane crash, 7 and a half when she was adopted by a wealthy, childless couple in Beverly Hills. During the second week in her magnificent new home, her adoptive father came into her room after midnight, exposed himself to her, and touched her in ways no grown man should ever touch a child. She had still been intensely grieving for her lost parents, humiliated, ashamed, frightened, alone, confused. She endured the man's depraved behavior for 3 months before desperately seeking help.
"But," I said,
"she reported it to a social worker who was making a house call for the adoption agency."
"Yes, dear, she did."
"So she was taken out of that place, and then she lived in St. Bart's orphanage till she graduated high school."
"Yes, but she wasn't removed for a week. Your lovely girl never realized that the first social worker wasn't the one who helped her. In fact, never would have helped her."
Having to discuss this, having to consider again what Stormy had told me about the abuse she suffered, I found that the memory came braided with heartache. Mrs. Fisher said,
"The couple who adopted Stormy."
She called them Mr. and Mrs. Hellborn, not their real names, obviously.
"But apt,"
Mrs. Fisher said.
"Mr. and Mrs. Hellborn weren't just corrupt. They were also corrupting of so many people who came into contact with them. And the first social worker was corruptible. Another caseworker in the same child welfare agency heard a few things and became suspicious. She was one of us."
By the gentle tenor of her voice, by the compassion in her eyes, by the hands with which she held my hand, she made it clear that what she had to tell me might leave me shaken, but that she would be my anchor through it all.
"The Hellborns thought of themselves as citizens of the world, which in their case meant they felt above the laws of any one city or state or country. They had lived in several exotic places where life is accorded less value than it is here. Tragic places where children of the slums are vulnerable, often regarded as a commodity. The crooked authorities let the Hellborns pursue their desires unobstructed, but they had a reputation among locals."
Stormy and I had never made love. She wanted to know beyond any doubt that I loved her for herself, not merely for the physical pleasure that she could give me. Considering what happened to her, considering that she'd triumphed over what would have destroyed many others, considering that she became such a self-sufficient, joyful person, I would have been a world-class jerk if I pressured her. Stormy wanted to wait for marriage. I wanted whatever Stormy wanted. Mrs. Fisher said,
"The Hellborns were making plans to take little Bronwyn out of the country aboard their 160-foot yacht. The Beverly Hills estate was owned by their corporation in the Cayman Islands. The corporation quietly listed it for sale. Those people would never have brought your girl back. Never. And God knows what might have happened to her."
At first it seemed to me that there was no good reason for Mrs. Fisher to tell me all of this. Stormy was gone. What might have happened to her didn't matter. What mattered was only what did happen to her, both at the hands of the Hellborns and years later on a day of evil at the Green Moon Mall? Why dwell on horrors that might have occurred?
She was, said Mrs. Fisher, the sweetest child, orphaned and abused and traumatized, but already determined not to be a victim, not ever again. I spent only 2 days with her, but they were days I will never forget, Adi. There she was, this precious little person, 40-some pounds, hardly taller than a lawn gnome, but determined to take on the world and win.
I said, nothing scared her, not really. She was afraid for me sometimes, but never for herself. Mrs. Fisher squeezed my hand.
The dear girl said her name, Bronwyn, sounded like an elf or a fairy, and she wasn't either one. She decided to find a strong name for herself. The second day we were together, there was a terrible storm. Such bright bolts of lightning, wind and thunder that shook the building. She stood at the window, watching it all, fazed by none of it, and that's where she found her new name.
I realized that I was squeezing one of Mrs. Fisher's hands so tightly that it must have been hurting her, though she didn't so much as wince, let alone try to pull away. I relaxed my grip. I never knew why she chose Stormy. It fit her so well, you know, because she had such power, such a strong presence. But there was no destruction in her, like there can be in a storm, none at all. Cocooned in the limo, with the purr of the engine and the soft light and the coolness issuing from the dashboard vents, I almost felt that we weren't in a mere car. We might instead have been aboard a more significant conveyance, perhaps outbound in space or traveling in time, seeking a world more peaceful than this one, or a future when, by some great grace, humanity had recovered its innocence and its birthright. The exclamation point brooch on Mrs. Fisher's lapel sparkled in the dashboard light when I looked at her again. I said, "At first I couldn't understand why you told me all this, but now I get it."
"I knew you would, child."
Sometimes when I'm feeling sorry for myself, it seems that I'm made to carry this impossibly heavy weight, the crushing weight of losing her. I have moments of bitterness and doubt, you know? But the weight is a blessing, really, and I shouldn't be bitter about it. The weight is on my heart because I knew her and loved her. The weight is the accumulation of all we had together, all the hopes and worries, all the laughs, the picnics in St. Bart's Bell Tower, the adventures we shared because of my gift. If they'd taken her away on their yacht, if I'd never met her, there would be no weight to carry, and no memories to sustain me. Mrs. Fisher smiled at me and nodded.
"Fully blue, and so very, very near to being fully smooth."
35. Minutes before the cultists found me, Mrs. Fisher drove me off the 2-lane blacktop and parked on the shoulder of the road, near the grove of cottonwoods in which I'd left the Ford Explorer. She shut off the engine, switched off the lights, got out of the limo, and came around to my side so that we could have a proper hug. She was bird-like, tiny, and yet I suspected that anyone who tried to mug her or hijack her would discover that being petite and 86 did not guarantee that she would be an easy target. Walking with me through the dark toward the trees, she said,
"I want you to know that Tim will be fine. Set your mind at rest about him. Some of our people are taking him into their family. They'll take the dog, too, Raphael. They have a golden retriever of their own and a 12-year-old boy, so Tim will have 2 dogs and an older brother."
What if his past starts coming back to him, who he was and all he went through?
"It won't come back to him, dear. Anna Maria tells me that she has spared him those memories. And he has new memories that give him a good foundation for a happy future."
I know he remembers a different past from what he actually lived. I just don't understand how it could be done. Not hypnosis, not drugs.
No, no, no. Good gracious. Nothing as crude as that.
Then what?
Well, it's all a little mystical, isn't it? Don't worry your lovely head about it.
Back in March, I reminded her, you told me I would eventually understand the true and hidden nature of the world. It's still hidden to me, ma'am.
That doesn't mean it's any less true, sweetie.
I'd come to love Mrs. Fisher, to trust her entirely. But at times our conversation seemed to have come straight from the Mad Hatter's tea party. I said, am I right to think you've known Anna Maria a long time? Much longer than I've known her?
Oh, yes, I've known her for ages.
Well, she's only 18.
Yes, dear, she's been 18 for ages.
Well, how does that work?
It works splendidly for her.
I was silent for a moment, and then I said, I could be inscrutable too, you know.
Actually, you couldn't, dear.
Who is she?
It's not for me to tell you, Adi.
So, who will tell me?
She will, when the time has come for you to know.
When will the time come?
You'll know the time has come when it comes, of course. You're so full of questions. You should be the host of a game show.
I sighed and stopped at the trees. We had neither moon nor stars. Her face was ghostly in the gloom. Her white hair veiled her head, all but her face, as if she wore some holy order. I didn't resort to my flashlight, because under her talk of game show hosts, I heard a repressed sadness and sensed that she might be struggling to hold back tears. If this might be my last encounter with, my last memory of, Mrs. Edie Fisher, I didn't want it to be one in which she wept. "Will I see you again?" I asked.
Of course you will, dear. You'll see everyone again. Let me have a question now. What is your next move?
You'll know my next move when it's time for you to know it.
You simply are not charming when you try inscrutability, dear. It's most unbecoming on you.
I'm sorry.
Is your little rebellion over now?
Yes, ma'am. My next move is... I've got to talk with Chief Porter and find out if he's gotten any new info on this Wolfgang Schmidt, one of the cultists.
Yes, one of the three that were shot in the back of the head by others of their ilk.
How do you know that? She pinched my cheek.
How could I not know, dear?
If you don't mind my asking, ma'am, and I'm sure you do, what's your next move?
As always, I'm an open book. I intend to pick up Anna Maria and Blossom Rosedale, where we're staying together, and go over to the fairgrounds for a couple of hours.
Hey, whoa, that's a bad idea, ma'am. I'm heading back there myself, 'cause I think that's where something pretty serious might happen. Not necessarily the big thing, not the whole town drown, but something not good. She clapped her hands together with girlish enthusiasm.
Well, isn't that where it's always the most fun to be? Where things are happening?
I hugged her again. Heathcliff must have been some guy, ma'am. I let her go. Tell me straight now. Do you know what's going to happen tonight?
No, Adi. For all you may think differently, I'm only human. Anna Maria's human, too, though she's more than that, as you no doubt suspect, but human nonetheless. We don't know. Whatever happens will happen because you and others make it happen.
Free will, I said.
Free will, she agreed. Our greatest gift, the thing that makes life worth living, in spite of all the anguish it brings.
Got to be going. I'm running out of time. I think we all are. I could see her nod only because her cap of white hair moved up and down. Goodbye, Mrs. Fisher.
Until we meet again, dear.
She made her way back to the limousine as if guided by some lamp that I could not see. I watched her get into the enormous car and drive away. She drove well. Back in March, her best friend and chauffeur of 22 years, Oscar Dunningham, had died of a massive heart attack at the age of 92. They had been at dinner in a superb restaurant in Moonlight Bay. As Oscar finished his last spoon of an excellent creme brulee, his eyes widened, and he said, "Oh, I think the time has come to say goodbye." And he slumped dead in his chair. According to Mrs. Fisher, although she usually tipped 25%, she tipped 75% because the waiter was kind enough to wipe a dribble of creme brulee off dead Oscar's chin. She was also pleased that the busboy, the waiter, and the maitre d' all continued to refer to the deceased as the guest, even as they assisted in his quiet removal from the dining room, leaving most of the other customers unaware that a death had occurred, and presenting Mrs. Fisher with a small box of chocolate mints, accompanied by a sympathy card. I would have liked to be her chauffeur. I'm sure the pay was good, and the benefits would have been unique. I switched on my flashlight, walked among the cottonwoods to the Explorer. Behind the wheel, I inserted the key in the ignition. As the engine turned over, I looked up, through the dusty windshield and between the trunks of the trees, toward the two-lane back road. Distant headlights flared. I would have driven from the cover of the trees if the vehicle hadn't been approaching so fast. On that narrow, curved, and potholed blacktop, such high speed was reckless, almost suicidal. The driver evidently needed to get someplace yesterday. Or maybe he needed to get to someone. Sometimes intuition tickled like a spider crawling along the back of my neck. At other times, it was a cold robot hand that clamped around my throat for a moment and wouldn't allow me to breathe. This time, robot hand. The oncoming vehicle closed on me so fast that I had no hope of getting to the road and away before it blocked access. I could tell now that the headlights were high off the pavement, as if it must be either a jacked-up SUV on big tires or a truck. Probably a truck. I switched off the engine, got out of the Explorer, hurried around to the passenger side to put the Ford between me and the road, drew the Glock from my shoulder rig. I was not, and never have been, a man of action. I only pretended to be one. I remained always aware that I was pretending, desperately trying to be Mr. Daniel Craig or Mr. Vin Diesel in one of their more assured performances. Consequently, I frequently felt foolish while doing all the jumping and running and brandishing guns that a man of action is called upon to do. Now, I felt like a self-delusional fry cook as I crouched beside the Explorer, Glock in hand, when it should have been a spatula, watching the truck rocket along the roadway. I told myself, "Don't be paranoid. It's just someone in a hurry. His wife's in labor, or his little boy swallowed an entire package of laxatives, and he doesn't want to wait for an ambulance. They're not looking for me. They're not worried I'll upend their plans. They have no way of locating me." The truck shifted gears. Brakes shrieked. The vehicle departed the pavement, angled toward the grove of cottonwoods, and jolted to a halt in a cloud of dust, the headlights slashing through the trees, cutting away some of the shadows, possibly revealing the Explorer. I heard what might have been a segmented steel door rolling up on the back of the truck, and, peering through the many trees, I glimpsed men spilling out of the cargo box. Not being bulletproof, as is the average man of action in the movies, I holstered the Glock, turned from the Explorer, and ran deeper into the cottonwood grove, trying not to think about trees, lest my psychic magnetism lead me face first into one. 36. Never before had I relied on my gift to guide me through a dark woods by concentrating on the idea of open land. Not until that very morning, of course, had I used it to find my way through a pitch-black shopping mall, and that had worked out all right. Perhaps this was a day of firsts. The day one dies, of course, is a first in any life. I held my right arm in front of my face, hoping to avoid having an eye poked out by a branch. With my left hand, I felt from tree to tree.
hurrying because enough thin blades of light from the truck's headlamps sliced through the grove to suggest where the cottonwoods relented a little. No undergrowth inhibited progress, but a thick carpet of dry leaves crunched noisily underfoot, so that if my pursuers stopped now and then to listen, they would have a pretty good idea of where I was headed. Instead of pausing to listen, however, they opened fire. For an instant I thought they must see me. Within a few steps I would be riddled. But then the explorer's windows shattered. Sheet metal cried out, pock and pong, as bullets tore into it. A couple of tires popped, and there could be no doubt that they were trashing the SUV with the expectation that I might be inside. The barrage was so ferocious that I couldn't tell if they were using fully automatic weapons, or if there were so many gunmen firing with such enthusiasm that it only sounded as though they were spraying the Ford with a couple of Uzis. Inevitably, there were ricochets and wild shots, and I heard a round thwack into a tree. If I could discern that particular sound separate from the crackle and roar of gunfire, the hit had to be nearby, mere inches away. Another bullet tunneled through sprays of leaves, spitting bits of bark and vegetation onto my head, into my face, and a third round impacted with a sound like an axe blade biting wood, which probably meant it was a high-velocity round, and perhaps a hollow point. The land sloped slightly, and if I remembered the neighborhood, there was an aquifer not too deep underground, so that the soil grew damp again each night, no matter what heat the Mojave sun blistered down on the land during the day. The aquifer slaked the thirst of the cottonwoods and made it possible for farms in this area to draw enough water from wells to grow crops. The assault on the explorer ended, and although my ears were ringing, I could hear that the dead leaves underfoot had lost most of their crunch. Surface roots became more prominent, and the air grew moist and thickened with the smell of moldering forest mast. I rushed off the slope into a wide swale, where the trees opened a little and where the detritus underfoot squished. Voices echoed through the woods. Although I couldn't make out their words over my own hard breathing, I imagined that the cultists, for who else could they be, were calling to one another, probably one of them giving directions to subordinates, each of those then answering, everyone getting on the same page. They would come through the woods in a search line, maybe 10 feet between them, depending on how many there were. After weaving through 20 or 30 yards of trees, through the swale, to where the land began to rise, I stopped and looked back and saw that they had switched off the truck's headlights. I waited to see flashlight beams, hoping to estimate their numbers, but the woods remained dark. They no longer called to one another. The entire crew couldn't have gotten back into the truck and driven away, not that quickly. Besides, I would have heard the engine starting. And they hadn't come after me so aggressively, only to retreat when they didn't nail me in the Explorer. They were still out there among the cottonwoods, in the dark, being quiet. What were they doing? Listening? Reloading after their exuberant reenactment of the D-Day landing? Taking a collective leak? The loud attack on the Explorer seemed crazy to me, even if they thought that I was inside that vehicle. We were in a rural area, but it wasn't on the dark side of the moon. There were woodlets and large fields, some weedy and some cultivated, but there were also a few ranchettes where horses were bred and raised. Not thoroughbreds, but quarter horses and various special breeds for sale to enthusiasts, which meant people were living in these parts. People who didn't usually hear barrages of gunfire in the night. If even one of them called the police, the odd Thomas Hunt would be interrupted by the authorities before I could be properly shot in the head and ritually dismembered. I knew it was dangerous to stand there listening, that I was wasting time. But I stood there listening anyway, because I didn't understand what they were doing, what was happening. In a life-or-death struggle with a formidable enemy, you had to make decisions based on accurate information. You couldn't always rely on intuition, even if your intuition, like mine, would probably make you a fortune at a roulette wheel or a blackjack table. Half a minute passed before one of the hunters put a foot wrong, thrashed through foliage, and cursed. Another voice ordered, "Quiet!" Somehow they were coming without lights to guide them. There was no accurate information to be gotten, No explanation for their stealth that wouldn't have to be puzzled out. And the only kind of analysis I had time for was the simple kind that could be done on the fly. Striving to focus my attention on the concept of open land. Open land. I wove among the cottonwoods, ascending the slope that rose out of the moist swale. Moving quickly. As fast as I dared. Not as blind as I was in the mall that morning, but definitely hampered by the gloom. Immediately above me, maybe a double score of birds exploded from their night roost, racketing through the trees and skyward. If my pursuers were experienced trackers who could get a directional bead on a sound in this environment, the flock erupting into flight would confirm for them my approximate position in the woods. At once, I turned sharply to the left, which I thought must be east, angling up the easy incline, hoping that their search line would reform to center on the place where the birds had spooked away from me. If I could get past the last man at the east end of their formation, while they were adjusting their hunt toward the southwest, I might be able to put some ground between me and them, maybe escape them entirely, but at least gain time to think. Open land, open land, open land. I wanted out of the trees as badly as any swimmer might want to get out of a water when spying the fins of a dozen schooling sharks. Even with psychic magnetism, however, even though I was not entirely blind in the night woods, I couldn't proceed as quickly as I had at moments in the pitch-black mall. Tree trunks complicated this darkness. Low-hanging branches, exposed roots. I kept moving, aware of crisp, dead leaves crunching underfoot again, hoping that the men behind me were making their own noises that masked mine. Maybe it would prove to be paranoia. Maybe it would prove to be true. But I sensed that my pursuers weren't nearly as hampered by the cottonwoods as I was. Maybe they had military night vision gear. One explanation. Logical. The cult's resources, a treasury built up over 4 1/4 centuries since their early days in Oxford, would enable them to acquire pretty much anything they wanted. Or they could steal it, as they'd stolen the C-4. I didn't know much about night vision goggles. In fact, nothing. I thought such devices needed at least starshine, a minimum of ambient light to magnify into an enhanced field of vision, but I could be wrong. More worrisome was the possibility that they could track me with the assistance of a supernatural power beyond my comprehension. No other quarry in my circumstances would have leapt to that suspicion, but because of my experiences, I had an open mind. Some might say that it was as open and empty as a wind tunnel. Nevertheless, in Nevada, the past March, I'd seen that the cultists could conjure entities not born of this world. In the court of Odd, even the most preposterous suspicion was admissible. Concentrating on open land while trying to evade the searchers probably established a conflict of needs. The emotional need for more light, more hope, versus the base animal need for cover, camouflage, a bolt hole. In the open, I might be more easily spotted, therefore less safe than if I remained in the woods. Such a conflict could explain why I stumbled, clipped one tree trunk with my left shoulder, another with my right, slipped and fell to one knee, thrust up, and took only a dozen steps before foundering against a projection of rock, over which I clambered as gracefully as if I'd been wearing clown shoes. In spite of this increasingly slapstick performance, I angled eastward until I staggered out of the cottonwoods near the crest of the slope, breathing too noisily. I strove to quiet myself. More but shallower inhalations. Draw air and exhale through the mouth only. Heart hammering, but they couldn't hear that. I ascended the last of the rise to a flat width of dirt and wild grass, beyond which a white plank and chicken wire fence ran east-west, barring my way. Under the unrelenting low cloud cover, the rural landscape offered better visibility than the woods, although it too was dim. And more than dim. I felt as if the night and the place held within them some recondite meaning that my eyes could not quite resolve out of the gloom, that my mind could not interpret. I peered west along the fence, toward where the posse might emerge from the trees, if I had indeed angled past the outermost man on the searchline. No one. In case they had not reformed their line toward the eruption of birds that I had caused, if they were instead close behind me, I needed to get off this open strip of land where I would be an easy target. I scaled the 5-foot-high board fence, snagged Mr. Bullock's sport coat on a twist of wire, tore the fabric getting free, and dropped into whatever might wait on the other side. 37. Although I hadn't remembered what I would find when I put the cottonwoods behind me, I knew at once where I was. Meravia Valley Orchards. Row after long row of almond trees running north-south. Precisely spaced to accommodate the harvesting equipment that would shake the ripe nuts from the branches. The alleys between the rows were likewise calculated, not merely to allow tractor-drawn harvest bins to pass, but to ensure that one rank of trees did not shadow the next for too much of the day, so that every side of every tree received a wealth of light as the sun traveled from dawn to dusk. Like dutiful sentinels standing watch, the trees dwindled into the dark, across a couple of 100 acres. Eager to put more distance between myself and the searchers before they might climb into the orchard to scope it out, I ran east along the barrier of boards and chicken wire. I'd gone only 30 or 40 feet when I saw black-clad figures scaling the fence, perhaps 60 feet ahead of me, far from where I thought they would be. In the woods, the posse had not reformed in the direction of the flock of birds that scattered skyward. Instead, as though anticipating my actions, they'd angled east. No one called out. I hadn't been seen. In a crouch, I scurried 6 feet to the south, to the last tree in the nearest row, and took cover there, frantically trying to think what to do next.